second every day, when every action, every thought will tell the world how you cast your vote.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 9:01, and it's time for APA Compass, featuring introduction to the new Jade District Night Market, and the collective says goodbye to member Andrew Yeh with highlights of some of his interviews. It's followed at 10 with Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre, followed at 10:15 by Flashpoints, and at 11, Shahid Hamid hosts It Takes a Village with a focus on Ferguson and police killings. At 11:30, we'll get a preview of the upcoming Justice Begins with Seeds conference and film series with organizer Miguel Robles and one of the speakers, environmental and native land rights lawyer Claire Hope Cummings. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support of KBOO. If you're not a current member, you can remedy that at kboo.fm. Click where it says Donate Today. And now, this.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Giants of Jazz and Blues, a benefit concert for American music program.
Giants of Jazz and Blues will take place on Friday, September the 5th, from 7:30 p.m. to 10 p.m., and features woodwind virtuoso Benny Maupin and acclaimed trumpet player Terrell Stafford, who will be joined by numerous well-known Portland musicians, including Rebecca Kilgore, Andy Stokes, LaRonda Steele, and more.
The concert will be held at the Winningstad Theater, 1111 Southwest Broadway in Portland. Again, that's Giants of Jazz and Blues, a benefit concert for the American Music Program. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Thanks for listening to APA Compass. On today's program, collective member Andrew Yeh speaks with Mi Mua, the Executive Director of Asian Americans Advancing Justice. You'll also get to hear more from Andrew in his exit interview with fellow collective member Kashlani D'Souza. As Andrew leaves Portland and the collective, we wanted to highlight some of Andrew's thoughtful and important pieces in a short compilation. But first, collective member Luann Ogoso introduces us to the new Jade District Night Market.
Hey, Good morning, this is Luann Algoso and you're listening to APA Compass. Today I speak with Jade International Night Market Coordinator, Jesse Burke. This summer, the Jade International District is launching Portland's first series of night markets in the Southeast 82nd neighborhood. Night markets around the world are generally connected with the night markets in Asia. Countries like China and Taiwan are known for their vibrant night markets. Places in North America have hosted night markets as well, like in San Francisco, Los Angeles, and Vancouver, British Columbia. Portland puts a unique twist on the night market by highlighting the international influences in the Southeast 82nd neighborhood, infusing not only the Asian community, but also the Russian, African, and Latino communities that reside in the neighborhood. Now Portland has our own night market, and we're excited to see how Portlanders will receive them. So where did the idea come from for the Jade International Night Market?
So the idea came from a steering committee that has been working together for the last several months to come up with some sort of placemaking event. So some neighborhoods do street fairs, and they wanted to do something similar, but taking into consideration this is the most diverse neighborhood in Portland, we wanted something that was unique to celebrate that mix. So we came up with an international night market.
And what can we expect at the night markets?
So the night market experience is a little bit different than you might have at a street fair or other type of event. With an international night market, we're trying to create a true international experience. So there will be a lot of different food vendors and cuisine types. There are performers from all over the world performing, and a mix of craft and flower vendors. And just to give you kind of an idea of the atmosphere, it's our first year doing this, so we started with a fairly confined space, but we've had a huge turnout, so it's very authentic to other night market experiences, which are, you know, it's crowded, it's loud, there are a lot of different languages being spoken, and a lot of excitement around the idea, and performers performing very different types of entertainment throughout the entire night. And it'll go into the night, so there are strong lights with lanterns, and so it becomes more intimate as the day goes on. And we'll also have a beer garden that's right near the entertainment stage. And to give you an idea of some of our performers, on September 6th, we'll have Rachel Wong, who's coming down from Seattle to perform, and Acoustic Minds. We open every night with a lion dance performance for good luck. We'll have the Portland State University Hip Hop Alliance, and I want to say three other performers that evening. And then on our final night, September 13th, again, we'll have the lion dance opening and several performers throughout the night, including the Yuet Sing Chinese opera and a wushu performance. And we're going to end the night with taiko drums.
And where can we find more information about the International Night Market?
We have several places that you can find more information. The first place I would look is the Jade District website, which is www.jadedistrict.org. We also have a very active Facebook and Twitter. So Facebook is, if you search for the Jade District Night Market, and on Twitter, you can find us at the handle Jade District.
Thank you to Jade International Night Market Coordinator Jesse Burke for making time to speak with us today. This is Luann Algoso for APA Compass.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to APA Compass. My name is Andrew Ye, and today we're speaking with Mi Mua, President and Executive Director of Asian Americans Advancing Justice. Mi Mua is an attorney and also served in the Minnesota State Senate for 3 terms. I'd also like to thank our friends at Apano, who brought Ms. Mua to Portland for APA Heritage Month and helped arrange this conversation. Mi, welcome to APA Compass.
Thank you, Andrew. I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
So you've got a great backstory, Mi, which I hope you'll share with our listeners. When you were a child, you and your family came to the United States as refugees from Southeast Asia. You were very poor and you grew up in the housing projects of Appleton, Wisconsin. And you're minorities in an overwhelmingly white Catholic community. So what was that experience like for you?
Well, you know, it was great in that there were a lot of really loving adults, from my teachers to my soccer coach to the librarians at the local libraries, who, you know, saw this raggedy Asian girl, and they really nurtured me and took me under their wings. I often talk about the fact that where my parents had their limitations because of the language and culture barriers, a number of these grown-ups really stepped in and helped provide some structure and some opportunities to in my life. And I think that that contributed a lot to my ability to be able to be successful when I was in grade school all through high school. That being said, I think that growing up in that environment had also its ugliness. And, you know, being a family of color in that kind of environment, we were subjected to a lot of racial slurs, a lot of really hateful racial acts. And I do believe, though, that it's because we came into that community in the immediate aftermath of the Vietnam War. And I think that a lot of Americans psychologically were still struggling themselves to how to find some resolution to their family members dying, to their own experiences in the Vietnam War. And so I think that in some ways, you know, we became the collateral damage to some of those unresolved hostilities that Americans themselves were experiencing as a result of the war.
Okay, so you worked hard in junior high and high school, academically speaking, and you applied for colleges. And so it's actually kind of unusual for people to move from, you know, the housing projects to actually to make it to a private university. And you end up going to Brown University. How did you manage to do that?
So my grandparents lived in Providence, and my uncle, when he graduated from high school, was looking for a school to go to. And according to him, he sort of looked around at his research, and because he was living in Providence and Brown was just on the hill, he decided to go to Brown. And it was really that uncle who led the way for the rest of, you know, the cousins. I'm the oldest grandchild of over 50 grandchildren coming from that side of the family. So when I was ready to graduate from high school, I went to my uncle and I said, where do you think I should apply to college? He gave me a list of like 10 schools to apply to, and I took it to my guidance counselor, and my guidance counselor said, well, are you sure you want to go to these schools? They're really expensive. I don't know that you can afford it. But I really respected my uncle, and I was a little bit more scared of him because he was my family member. So I said, well, I'll just do as my uncle told me. And it turns out later I figured out that these were some of the most elite, expensive schools in the country. In retrospect, I think that, you know, for a lot of these institutions, I could think about going to these schools because we were so poor that either I was going to get in on enough scholarships to make it worth for me, or, you know, not be able to go at all because if I didn't get any scholarships. And I think that I was able to get to Brown because we were so poor that there was enough with a combination of scholarships and student loans that I was able to attend the school.
So later on, you did get your law degree from Minnesota. And soon after that, you actually ran for the Minnesota State Senate, right? So what were your reasons for wanting to run for political office?
Well, you know, I actually didn't have deep aspirations to run for political office. I thought that I would spend about a decade in private practice, pay off some of my student loans. And then I actually wanted to become a government employee, both either at the state level or at the federal level, doing public policy work. And in between college and law school, I actually detoured to the University of Texas at Austin, the LBJ school, and got a master's in public policy, concentrating primarily on poverty policy. And so I thought that after a while, I actually was going to end up in government somewhere working on poverty policies. But during the time when I decided to run for the Senate seat, I had taken a leave of absence from my job at the law firm. And when the opportunity unexpectedly became available, my husband and I have been doing a lot of community organizing to get the Asian American community to register to vote. And so we thought it actually would be really fun to be in a special election. And that even if we didn't win, we would use the election as an opportunity to provoke the Asian American in that area, particularly the Hmong American community, to register to vote. And for us, that would be a win because we would actually be expanding the voter base. So that was our strategy, is that to make ourselves a candidate, to be able to have the ability through the candidate forums to shape the issues that affected our community, and that regardless of who ultimately won that seat, once we've placed those issues on the platform, that then as a community we will be able to hold those candidates accountable to responding to the community. And so that became our strategy, issue-based, and then organize the community to get them out to vote. And I guess we were so successful in our community organizing and registering people to vote that we ultimately won the primary. And in that district, the primary is the election. And so, I actually ended up in office. And because I didn't think I would win, and that's why I went into the process, once we won the election, it was sort of like, oh, wow, like I actually am going to have to be a state senator. And it was funny, a lot of the media came to me and said, how does it feel to be the first Hmong American state legislator? And I'm like, oh, am I really the first? You know, and in some ways people presume or assume that I was running with that with sort of that opportunity in mind, when it very much was very far from my consciousness. And when I realized, I'm like, ooh, you know, we didn't really think about all of those community implications beyond the organizing aspect of the campaign.
So many people find it much harder to get into politics, right? Because you need to have money or you need to have connections and a whole network. Maybe even you have generations of people that were in politics previous to you. I mean, did you have any of that support?
Not really. So the one thing I had going for me is that I was always a community organizer. And so even when I was in law school, I was deeply engaged in registering people to vote. On my own, I became involved and engaged in the political process. And let me back up a little bit, is that in some ways it is generational in my family, because when I was in law school, my uncle decided to run for the St. Paul Public School Board. And he thought that because I was in school, I didn't have anything to do, so he conscripted me to run his campaign. So it was really through that experience that I got to know the political party process. I actually got elected to sit to be the secretary of the City of St. Paul's Democratic Party. I got to know a lot of elected officials. I did a lot of campaign work for Paul Wellstone, for Bruce Vento. Really got to know a lot of the local elected officials. So it really was through the party work. But I never was engaged thinking that I was building a profile towards a political, you know, a run for political office. I really was doing it as a part of an opportunity to organize the community. When I actually made the decision to run for the seat, actually many of the party leaders became gatekeepers, and many of them were the ones who told me that I had not done enough in the party, that I needed to wait my turn. And because my election was a special election right after a very contentious mayoral race that got my state senator elected mayor for the City of St. Paul, when I started calling all the political operatives who are the usual campaign workers, no one returned my call because they were all vacationing in, you know, Florida. And so I really didn't have I wasn't anointed. I didn't really have anybody other than my state representative, Representative Sheldon Johnson, who basically said, whatever you need my help with, I'll help you. And I thought he really was very unusual in his kindness and his willing to put himself out there for someone like me. But I didn't have a campaign machine. I had no political money. I had no political relationship. And all I had was myself. I remember earlier I said that I am the first of 50 cousins. And so I myself and my cousin machine. And I often tell the story that I had done a CLE in my first year after I was out of law school. In which they brought a campaign organizing in to talk about campaigns and elections. And I just did it because it was convenient and it filled, you know, my CLE requirements. But I went back to the CLE manual and I actually pull out the org chart. I pull out the position descriptions for a campaign manager, for a campaign fundraiser, for a campaign treasurer. I call all my first cousins into the room and I basically had, I drew up an org chart and I had all their names filled out on the org chart. And I basically announced to them that I was going to run for office and I had an org chart and, you know, this is what you're going to do. And they said, well, but we don't know what this position means. And I said, oh, don't worry, I have a job description for you. So I pulled out the job descriptions and I handed out to them. And literally, I mean, I think that's why we were so successful, because we did not know anything about campaigns. And we sort of made things up as we went along, so long as we were within, you know, the campaign finance laws, we just made it up. And I think we were so earnest in what we were doing that it actually inspired people out of inspiration, but out of sympathy to become part of the campaign. And, you know, that kind of blind earnestness is also part of what's missing these days, right, around politics and campaign, is that there's a certain genuine earnest authenticity that comes across when you're really organizing the community for the sake of really organizing the community. And it ceases to feel slick about just trying to get somebody elected, but it's really about how do we use this campaign as an opportunity to really reach out to the communities that have never been reached, touch communities that have never been touched, and bring into the fold those who are so dismissed and distant and disenfranchised from the political process. And that was how we ran the campaign, and that's how we were able to register not just, you know, the new Americans, the Asian Americans, but we actually brought into the fold lots and lots of disenfranchised mainstream voters, African American voters, Latino voters, urban Indian voters, who actually had never been asked to participate in the political process. And that's how we ultimately were able to win the primary and then ultimately win the election.
How do you get the voices of these disenfranchised people and actually have legislation passed which benefits them?
Many of them don't have a lot of expectations. In fact, you know, earlier today at a lunch, I talked to a group of young Asian American women, and I said to them that if they wanted to be engaged in politics, they need to be engaged, but they need to be so deeply engaged that candidates and elected officials are so grateful to them that they can go back and collect that gratitude, right? And in a lot of ways, that's what you're doing, is that you're trading your energy. As a community person, you volunteer to work for candidates that you support in the hope that once they're in office, that you can go to them and have them deliver on the things that really matter to you. But, you know, for our community and for the communities who've been disenfranchised, they are just so excited that somebody who is a reflection of who they believe they are. They're just so excited to have somebody who's more reflective of their experiences sitting in that seat, for them to be able to say, yeah, I did something that contributed to that. They were just really grateful. I even had a group of people who usually aren't part of my social circle, but they're, you know, they all belong to a bikers club, like hardcore Hell's Angel type bikers club. And you know, it really was through a relationship of a man who was a construction contractor who was actually working on the building where our campaign was being run out of. And he was watching the work that we were doing every single day. He became so inspired. And this is a Republican, like a mainstream white Republican guy. But he was just so moved by the work that we were doing that he became part of our campaign. And then one day he said, you know, I belong to a bicycle club and we're going to do a bike ride, and we want to endorse you, and do you mind if, like, we ride our bikes with your campaign t-shirt? And I'm like, oh my gosh, I will be so proud. And they made campaign t-shirts with my campaign logo on one side, but on the back of it, it says Bikers for Me, M-E-E. And they rode as a group with my name on the back. And I think that it really was a reminder to people that, you know, if you look at my friend Doug and if you look at me, people would say someone like Doug would never vote for me. But there was something really tangible about the relationship in that, you know, in me, Doug saw my experiences as being a disadvantaged, poor individual and yet still fighting for the rights. To exercise my rights as an American citizen. We really resonated on that level. And for him to, without me asking, willingly go out and basically recruited his biker friends to become, you know, a contingent of my campaign, that's what community organizing is about. When you're able to transcend your natural base and be able to bring into the fold communities that would otherwise never have an opportunity to participate. That's one of my proudest moments is to be able to connect with communities like that. And so it really is through that kind of campaign process that we're able to be so successful.
Wow, that's amazing. Asian Americans are in general underrepresented in American politics. So why is that and what can be done to reduce those barriers?
Well, I think that more and more Asian Americans are becoming to get involved. I think that the historically high number of Asian Americans in Congress right now is a prime example. And that didn't just happen. I think that that evolved because, you know, the decade or two prior to this 113th Congress, there were some efforts to build the pipeline. And it is also no accident that a majority of these individuals came out of California. So in the East and West Coast, where there has been a, you know, a legacy of Asian Americans participating in local politics, I think that it's no surprising that we're having Asian Americans who are emerging at the national, federal congressional offices. Who are Asian Americans. But I do think that, you know, it's hard to be Asian American in communities where you are but a small pocket. And, you know, for a lot of the Asian American community, we need to survive. Being a political refugee, you know, my parents, remember, they told me that I was to become, you know, a doctor, an engineer, or a lawyer. They didn't say, you know, go off to college and come back and run for public office, right? Because we don't have the legacy. Like you say, we don't have the multi-generation of families who have done it, and then they come back and do it. And I'll tell you, it was because my uncle ran for office that I learned about the campaigns and elections process. I ran for office and won. It was in the state Senate. In my last term in the state Senate, my sister ran for the school board and was elected into the school board. And the reason why, you know, people say, well, the Moore dynasty is taking over. No, it's because we had the campaign machine in place that we could quickly pivot that campaign machine and unleash it, you know, when we have a candidate who is viable. And so that's what we need to do. We need to identify people who want to run for office, but we need to also grow and nurture young people who know how to run campaigns. You know, we need to grow campaign managers. We need to grow campaign fundraisers. We need to grow campaign workers. And that's why organizations like APANO is so important, because, you know, the civic engagement work that they're doing, the community organizing work that they're doing, that's all C3, right? Nonpartisan community engagement work. But I see that army of young people who are doing the issue organizing as a ready pool of people that, you know, if there's an Asian American who says, I'm going to run for governor in the state of Oregon, we could quickly take those campaign C3 issue organizers, community organizers, and pivot and turn them into campaign organizers very quickly. It's the same methodology. It's the same kind of, you know, hard pounding the pavements, knocking on doors, engaging one-on-one with the community. It's the same kind of skills. And so we have to grow the campaigns and election worker base, but we also have to grow and identify candidates who want to run.
The Asian American population in general is getting more diverse, no longer just you know, Chinese Americans and Japanese Americans, but representatives from other places in Southeast Asia and South Asia are here as well. Are there key issues that resonate with large numbers of Asian Americans?
Well, I think that for the Asian American community as a whole, it doesn't matter if you're fifth generation Asian American or you've only been here for 5 weeks, right? And you're Bhutanese. We have a similar barrier that we all have to cross over, which is that we are and always be perceived as a perpetual foreigner. We are and always be translated and interpreted as the permanent immigrant. And those twin barriers, those twin burdens has translated into real structural institutional barriers that has prevented, you know, third generation Asian American small business owners from being able to access small business, minority-owned, women-owned contract opportunities with, you know, the cities or the state or the federal government. It is the same result from, you know, being these perceived as these foreigners that is preventing the newest families of Asian American immigrants students from being able to access jobs and education opportunities. So, you know, in the bigger picture, we have the same common barrier. We may come from different ethnic backgrounds, but once you hit this country, really none of these people can tell us apart. And at the end of the day, you know, our uniqueness in our culture and our language, our religious practices is the richness of what binds us within our community. But in the external community, we're all translated into one people. And so I often talk about this thing called the political Asian identity, that we could choose to say, no, I'm not Asian, I'm Hmong. Or we can choose to say, yep, I'm Asian. And for someone like me and my work, I like the idea of being able to claim entitlement and ownership of the continuum of the Asian American contribution in this country. I want to be able to say the reason why civil rights work is important in the Asian American community, that we're entitled to be a part of that conversation, is because we were the railroad workers and we were the sugarcane indentured servants and we were the civil rights fighters and we were the college campus agitators that once we embrace that one Asian American identity, political or otherwise, we are given ownership and entitlement to the continuum of the Asian American history in this country that gives us entitlement to continue to fight for the collective Asian American community. And so in my mind, I feel like, you know, as we think about the diversity within Asian American community, it is so beautiful. And yet I think what binds us and brings us together is that collective political Asian identity. And you know, I look at a place like Portland and I look at an organization like Apano. I look at places like Seattle. I look at places like Minneapolis and St. Paul. I look at places like New York City. If you think about it, you know, the survival of the newest generation of Asian American immigrants has depended on the know-how and the institutional roots and the institutional establishment of the prior Asian American organizations that has helped to soften the landing for the newest generation of immigrants who have come to this country. We've had to take care of ourselves. No one, you know, has stepped up to do that. And so it's interesting that the Southeast Asian, the Hmong American nonprofits in Minneapolis, St. Paul are stepping up to help integrate the newest generation of Koreans and Bhutanese and Nepalese who are coming into the country, you know, Burmese who are coming into the country. Again, it's each successive generation of Asian immigrants really reaching out and helping to integrate the next newest generation. And that's really what binds us as an Asian American community, and that's really what's strengthening us. And that's why at the end of the day, we may be diverse, but we care about education opportunities for our children. We care about jobs for people in our community. We care about a fair chance, a decent shot of being able to own a business, not being discriminated against. And we care deeply about life in this country. You know, many of us came here perhaps forced by our refugee and immigrant status. But in this country, we have found an opportunity to really be able to thrive and to do well. And I think Asian Americans are deeply, deeply committed to their civic duty and their civic engagement. And so part of what's exciting is that once, you know, we've been able to connect with Asian Americans and get them registered and get them in the practice of voting, many of them are very, very loyal and very dutiful, and that they'll come back and vote. And they'll vote because they feel so proud to be able to exercise their civic duty. And I'm very proud of that. And I think those are all the things that bind us together despite our differences as Asian Americans.
You're an example of somebody who pursued the American dream and has been successful at it. But, you know, it's becoming sort of harder and harder as the years go by for people to achieve that American dream, you know, because the income wealth gap in America continues to widen, you know, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. So what can be done to reverse this trend?
You know, I always say that the successes of the first generations should not blind us to the barriers that continue to exist for the next three generations. That we as a community cannot bask in the myth of the exceptional Asian because the first generations have been successful. We cannot bask in that when the next three generations of our communities are living in jeopardy. And it is due in part to all the things that you've talked about. I don't think that I'm going to be able to afford for my children to go to Brown University. I mean, that's just the reality. You know, my husband and I are part of the working class, the working middle class. Legacy, association with these, you know, elite institutions, notwithstanding, we just don't have the wealth and the income to be able to have our children be able to access, you know, these elite institutions. But I'm kind of okay with that reality, right? It is interesting that, you know, when we think about the wage gaps, it's real. It's real. We have beyond my generation, who are sort of the first generations, who are the self-makers, right? You know, we need to be really thoughtful and be really conscientious about continuing to create the opportunities, to identify, to broaden and deepen those economic opportunities for the next generation, for the second generation, for the third generations. You know, beyond the first generation, Asian Americans, our community, no longer have the attractiveness of being a first generation participants in our family. They will encounter all kinds of barriers that maybe someone like me, who is a perceived to be an exceptional first generation, sometimes being in that role has given me opportunities that I don't think my children are going to be able to have. And so the wage gaps, the wage inequalities, the lack of job opportunities, all of that really comes to play. You know, in my generation, I would have been really happy working for, you know, as a state employee at $40,000, $50,000, $60,000. My expectations of what my earning potentials are based off of what my parents' earning potentials were. And so my expectations are different. The second, third generation, they have a whole different set of expectations. Many of them have parents like my husband and I, you know, who have invested a tremendous amount of resources, cultivated our children to think big, reach high, dream big. And yet many of our children who have been inculcated and embedded with that kind of thinking are thinking big, dreaming big, and yet once they come out of school, they hit the reality of the glass ceiling and the bamboo doors, and it's difficult for them to be able to access the Googles and the corporations that they want to be a part of. And so there is a little bit of what I call the second generation disillusionment that is real, and it is really those kind of disillusionments that directly contributes to, you know, the income gap and the lack of income equality within the community, but vis-a-vis also the rest of the other racial and ethnic groups in the country. And so is there a strategy? You know, I am not sure. That is the question of the day, and we struggle with that. And fundamentally, we can fix that for the Asian American community by participating in the broader discussion of how do we actually fix that income inequality for the rest of this country. We have to realize and recognize that Asian Americans will continue to experience a lot of those barriers. And this is why, you know, it is really hard when I'm engaging in conversations at the national level and people say, oh, Asian Americans are doing great. They're highly educated. They have high income. You know, they're doing great. Well, that's fine, but, you know, that's permitting the model minority, the American exceptional myth, to really mask some of the real challenges and the real realities that many in our community continue to face.
We've been chatting with Mi Mua, President and Executive Director of Asian Americans Advancing Justice. Mi, it's been fantastic talking with you.
I love it. Anytime, Andrew.
Thanks for listening to APA Compass. I'm Kashlani DeSouza, and today I'm speaking with APA Compass's own Andrew Yeh. He's one of our most prolific, consistent, and fantastic collective members, and has been working with APA Compass over the last 5 years. Andrew's trading Portland for the sunny state of Hawaii very soon,
And until we can convince him to be our Hawaii correspondent, APA Compass will have to manage without him as a regular contributor. So we decided to turn the tables on him today and ask him a few questions about his experiences at KBOO and APA Compass. Thanks for being on the show today, Andrew.
Thanks, Kalshani.
How does it feel to be on the other side of the mic?
It's very unusual. I've never sat on this side of the table before.
Now, I know you're a research scientist, an engineer by training and by trade, but I wanted to ask you a little bit about how you got started doing community radio. I mean, have you always harbored this secret desire to become a radio journalist?
So it never actually crossed my mind to become a journalist or get onto radio. When I first moved to Portland, I think I was looking around for other things to do with the Asian American community, and APA Compass was one of the things that came up on my list of things that I noticed, and I listened to some of the shows, and I thought it was actually a pretty fun thing. I think I downloaded all the archives I could find from the KBOO.fm website, and I really enjoyed listening to what I heard. And after that, I actually ran into a couple of the collective members socially around town. So I think I met Patty Sakurai, as well as Marie Lowe, and it came up conversation that they're in APA Compass. And after talking to them and finding that they're pretty fun people, I was like, I should join.
And we are very glad that you did. But have you always thought of yourself as an activist or a storyteller?
Not so much. I think it was more from a personal interest point of view, because I grew up in some place that did not have a whole lot of Asian Pacific Americans. And, you know, so I've always been interested in, you know, how my race and ethnicity affects, you know, who I am and how other people perceive me. So it was more for a personal journey rather than a, you know, activist sort of mission.
Now, you've produced a lot of stories over the last 5 years. You've talked to novelists, musicians, scientists, activists, artists, you name it. And I was wondering if there is a particular type of story that you like telling?
Yeah, so probably one of the types that I really enjoyed is actually learning about maybe some histories that are not well publicized or not well known. So when I came to the West Coast, I realized that, you know, Asians, Chinese Americans, Japanese Americans have been in this part of the country for, you know, for many, many generations, for, you know, 150 years or longer. But many of their stories are not told. There are several stories that I enjoyed, like hearing Linda Tamura's book on Nisei soldiers break their silence about the World War II vets. That was really interesting. Gregory Noakes had this Massacre for Gold, a nonfiction, which actually talked about the Chinese that were in Eastern Oregon mining for gold. Anne Wetherill has a nice exhibit she put together about the Flying Tigers, about the large number of Chinese Americans that came out of Portland to be pilots. You know, all these stories were very unexpected, but part of the local history.
Actually, a group of us got together and we were talking about what some of our favorite pieces have been. And the one we picked to air later in the show today is actually one of those historical perspectives an author writing about his experiences in Cambodia. Right. Can you tell us a little bit about the Golden Leaf story?
Sure. That was Kee Lung Ung. Kee Lung came from Cambodia, and he was a child in the Khmer Rouge regime. So he actually came to the U.S. and made his way in the U.S. Starting from basically nothing, right, as a refugee. And I would say that he's made it. You know, he's written a book about his experiences. He's done well for himself in his professional life as well as his personal life, and also become a community leader in Portland. Kee Lung's a great guy. He's one of the unexpected treasures that I came across when I was interviewing, because I didn't know anything about him or what kind of story he had to tell until I started interviewing him, and he had fantastic stories to tell about his own experiences both in Cambodia and in the U.S.
One of the things that I really have enjoyed about your stories over the years is that you have a way of putting guests at ease. Sometimes when you've got a microphone in your face, it gets really nerve-wracking. And to talk about something so personal and so important as experiences growing up under a regime like the Khmer Rouge, that can be pretty difficult to talk about. And we'll hear in that interview that you really do a great job of covering a really difficult topic in a sensitive and relevant way.
I've received actually a couple of compliments from my interviewees who've told me that, you know, they've talked about things they don't usually talk about during interviews with me. So I figured that means I'm doing a good job.
Yeah, you're disarming that way. So can you tell us about one of the more challenging stories that you've produced or been a part of?
So that must be my interview with Sandra Singh Lo. I'd known her previously with some of her work on This American Life and on NPR, and she'd written about about children and family and things like that. So when I heard she had a new book out, I thought I jumped on it and volunteered to interview her. Then I found out her book's about menopause and realized I might not be the most qualified person to interview her. So I had to do a lot of background research to figure out what questions to ask, and it sounds a little bit knowledgeable about the subject.
As I recall, though, that story went just fine, right? I think she was impressed by the end.
Oh, and she's great too, because she's very experienced and she's a comedian, so she's a natural interviewee. At the end of the interview, I thanked her and she thanked me, and she ended it by saying, "You're a brave man."
That's very true. So, Andrew, as you know, we're going on a mission soon to bring some new members into the APA Compass Collective, not to replace you, but to help us keep bringing APA public affairs news to the community. So I'm wondering if you could tell our listeners who might be thinking about becoming contributors to the program, what are some of the things about community radio that you've enjoyed? What's it going to do for them?
I've actually gotten to meet some of the authors that I've really loved, whose works I've really loved reading over the years. And finally, I got to meet them in person. And boy, that's such a joy, right? Just have a nice conversation with somebody whose work I really appreciate. So part of it's meeting all those, maybe your Asian American heroes. You can call people up that you've always wanted to talk to before, but you never had an excuse to talk to them before. And then you can invite them to come on the radio show with you. And the other part, I think, is actually interacting with both the APA Compass community as well as the local community in Portland.
So I just want to thank you very much, Andrew, for taking the time to talk with us today and for taking way more time than this short little interview over the last 5 years to put together some of our some of APA Compass's best work. Thanks.
It's been a pleasure.
We're going to miss you.
Thanks, Kaslani.
You are listening to APA Compass, and as you heard in Kishlani's interview with him, collective member Andrew Yeh is headed out of town. Andrew has been a huge contributor to APA Compass over the last 5 years, with not just his thoughtful interviews, but also playing a key role in ensuring there's actually been a program ready to air. This month, the APA Compass Collective wanted to highlight some of his pieces and asked Andrew to pick a few of his favorites. Here's just a tiny sample of Andrew's great contributions to APA Compass. Starting with the Congressional Gold Medal Celebration, where some of the local Japanese-American veterans of World War II were honored.
These American soldiers of Japanese descent fought with high distinction and record-setting decoration counts. Ironically, many of the soldiers' families were placed in internment camps during World War II in an act of government racism justified by war hysteria. Unfortunately, the racism persisted after the end of the war, with many Nikkei families unable to reclaim their property and reestablish themselves in their former neighborhoods. In an attempt to right the wrongs of the past, the government apologized and paid nominal reparations 40 years after the war, and awarded the Congressional Gold Medal 60 years later. I had the pleasure of speaking with several of the veterans. Roy Matsumoto served as a Japanese language intelligence specialist with Merrill's Marauders in the Burma campaign. Merrill's Marauders became famous for their deep penetration missions behind Japanese lines, frequently facing Japanese forces greater than their own. Matsumoto was essential to the Marauders' success. While his battalion was trapped in Napumga, Matsumoto crawled away every night to the Japanese lines to overhear their plans and played a critical role in the subsequent battle. He tells us what happened.
What did you serve in during World War II?
In Burma. It was Merrill's Marauders.
And what was your role there?
I went to language school and graduated, assigned to General Stilwell's army, and General Merrill invaded Burma, and I accompanied them.
So you were a translator then?
Yes, translator, interrogator, investigator, mm-hmm. all kind of intelligence work.
So I understand it was difficult being a Japanese-American serving in the Pacific Theater.
Right.
Because there was always worries that you'd be mistaken.
Yeah, sure, that's right. The danger. Mm-hmm. Yes, and then pretty hard to tell from Vietnamese or natives and Japanese and Chinese. See? All mixed up there. So, well, of course, we're being protected, but pretty dangerous situation.
For his heroics, Matsumoto earned the Bronze Star, the Legion of Merit, and of course the Congressional Gold Medal. He was inducted into the Ranger Hall of Fame and the Military Intelligence Hall of Fame, and has the distinction of being the only person inducted into two halls of fame. More details about Matsumoto and his amazing story can be found in the documentary, Honor and Sacrifice, The Roy Matsumoto Story. You're listening to APA Compass, and my name is Andrew Ye. Today we welcome Keelung Ung as our special guest. Keelung is a survivor of the Khmer Rouge rule in Cambodia from 1975 to 79. The 1984 drama film, The Killing Fields, helped tell the story of this era. Keelung has written his memoir, Golden Leaf, a Khmer Rouge genocide survivor, to share his experiences. He survived and escaped to Thailand, and eventually landed in Portland, Oregon for high school and college. Keelung, it's a pleasure to have you join us today.
Thank you, Andrew.
So how old were you at the start of the Khmer Rouge regime? And could you give us a picture of your family life before that time?
I was a teenager. I was born sometime in the early 60s when the Khmer Rouge took over in 1975. I had a normal life like everybody else. I completed seventh grade. And my mother was selling food to support the family. My sisters and I were in schools. And all of that went away in 1975.
So estimates of the total number of deaths from the Khmer Rouge policies, they range from 20 to 30% of the population, which at the time was around 8 million people. Your family, unfortunately, was not spared. You lost 10 members of your family and over 50 relatives, including your parents and grandparents and a sister. Would you consider your experience to be unfortunate but typical, or was your family especially targeted by the Khmer Rouge?
I say unfortunate, but also typical. Everybody you talk to lose a handful to 10, 15 people in the family. So, the feeling is I think it's about 2 million people that were killed.
And could you share an experience from that period of your life? Maybe something that's really stuck with you over the years or something that was life-changing?
Starvation is probably the most excruciating and the most memorable thing, especially if you have to do it for a period of time between 1975 and 1979. Watching people die every day, have to go to work, and being a slave and had no freedom, those are some of the things that it's always stuck in my mind.
Now fast forward almost 30 years.
All right.
So what prompted you to write your memoir, Golden Leaf?
For decades, even though, I began to have successes in life, the memory was still hurting me. I had a nightmare every night. My average sleep is 3 to 4 hours a night. And it was hurting. So you want to forget this memory. Okay, so on the one hand, I wanted to forget the memory that was hurting me. And then on the other hand, if I were to forget all this bad memories, this horror, all of the things that happened would have happened in vain. I lost my parents, and if I lost this memory, and then that memory would be gone. And then the other thing is, I wanted to leave behind, I want an evidence. So this is an evidence that things that happened, and I want my children to learn about it. It's much easier to write it down and have the children read the story as they get older and as they're ready, rather than just trying to tell them. So I published a book, and after I published a book, I don't remember when's the last time I had a nightmare since I published a book in 2009.
And finally, a very powerful Asian American activist minute.
My name is Andrew Ye, and this is my Asian American Activist Minute. This is a story about my daughter. It's a story about how I try to protect my girl and to keep her away from prejudice and discrimination. And then, long before I expected it, racial issues crept into her life, and I had to decide what to do. The incident happened at her friend's birthday party. It's an organized play party.
at a place with an indoor gym, games, activities, and two super chipper 20-something teachers to lead them. The teachers have the kids singing, dancing, and laughing in no time at all, and the kids just love it. Except for the three kids who are not singing, dancing, or laughing. These three are wallflowers, hanging back, not playing well with the group, and not quite self-confident enough to join in. Somehow, they are different. They are different in behavior and in appearance. They are a Latina girl, a half-Asian, half-Caucasian boy, and my Asian-American daughter. All of the Caucasian kids at the party are comfortably playing with the main group. All of the minority kids are not in that group. Somehow, the kids in the party self-segregated into majority and non-majority groups. How did this happen? Do they even realize that this happened? I should tell you that the kids at this party are 3 years old. 3 years old. Does discrimination start at age three? Maybe I'm overreacting. Maybe it's just a few kids being shy. It could be chance that the three shy kids are exactly the three minority kids. After all, three-year-olds are so innocent, far too young to think about race. I'm Asian, so I do the math. It's 2,000 times more likely that this is a racial than a chance event. I'm not overreacting. It appears that there are racial issues at age three. I do some searching and find lots of interesting research on kids and their racial beliefs. It confirms what I noticed at the birthday party. Almost all kids start noticing racial differences at ages 3 to 4. Some 3-year-olds ignore or avoid kids they perceive to be different. 5-year-olds start developing their ethnic identity. By age 7, kids notice racism directed against their own group. By age 9, racial attitudes are largely established, barring life-changing experiences. The research says that there's this narrow window which starts at age 3 and ends at age 9, which is crucial for developing one's racial attitudes. That's all the time we have. We have 6 years to learn whatever we can about race, and then our racial thought processes are pretty much set for the rest of our lives. Since the clock is ticking for my daughter, I want to actively engage her before this window closes so she can pick up the tools she needs to be racially self-confident. To help her develop tools, we will talk about our cultural background. We will read books featuring people of color. We will spend time with diverse friends. We will attend cultural events of our own and different ethnicities. I will talk to her school about fostering an anti-bias classroom environment. And I will ask of you, talk to your kids about cultural differences and make the world a more accepting place. My name is Andrew Yeh, and this is my Asian American Activist Minute.
Thank you for listening to APA Compass. The APA Compass Collective would like to thank the folks from the Jade District Night Market, Mi Mua, and a special thanks to our collective member, Andrew Yeh. The APA Compass Collective thanks you for 5 years of pretty darn good radio production. Best of luck to you and your family. APA Compass Archive Podcast can be found at apacompass.wordpress.com. For questions, comments, or ideas, please go to our APA Compass Facebook page. Tune in at 9 a.m. every first Friday of the month to APA Compass, here on KBOO Community Radio.
KBOO is preparing for our legendary book and record sale happening on Sunday, September 14th at the Volunteers of America building, 537 Southeast Alder Street in Portland. We're accepting donations of books, comics, LPs, CDs, DVDs, VHS, and cassette tapes, and all donations are tax deductible. Your discards are another person's treasure, and all sales benefit your community radio station, KBOO. So bring those donations down to the station, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, during our business hours. For more information, please contact Jesse, 503-231-8032, extension 213, or online via email, volunteer at kboo.org. That's the annual book and record sale on Sunday, September 14th.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Enemigo Imperialismo, Enemy Imperialism, a bilingual community art exhibit that explores the dimensions of imperialism in the world today. The opening of this art show will be Friday, September 5th at 6 p.m. at the Independent Publishing Resource Center, 1001 Southeast Division Street in Portland. Artists around the world have responded to violence with work that questions the legitimacy of the state and empire. Enemigo Imperialismo points to one of our common targets in the fight for global justice and invites us to reflect on power, resistance, and self-determination. Again, that's Enemigo Imperialismo. The opening of this art show will be Friday, September 5th at 6 p.m. at the Independent Publishing Resource Center, 1001 Southeast Division Street in Portland. The show will be up until September 25th. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 10:01 a.m. Coming up is Air Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre, followed at 10:15 by Flashpoints, looking at the FBI's terrorist watch list and the U.S. government admission that more than 40% of the persons on the list have, quote, no recognized terrorist affiliation, unquote. At 11, Shahid Hamid hosts It Takes a Village with a focus on Ferguson and police killings. And at 11:30, we'll get a preview of the upcoming Justice Begins with Seeds conference and film series with organizer Miguel Robles and one of the speakers, environmental and native land rights lawyer Claire Hope Cummings. Thanks, KBOO members, for your continued